We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Persh and Maria Tomczyk, both formerly with Eat the State. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning.
We say that because Eat the State hasn't been publishing for a while, so
yeah, it's true. But there are some other things going on which we'll talk about in due course.
Which will be revealed as
behind the curtain.
That's right. All right. So still plenty to cover every week, especially this week. A couple initiatives on the ballot.
Yeah, this week the city council referred two initiatives to voters, and voters will have a chance to vote on them on the November ballot. The first one is I-107. It's a union-backed initiative to increase the minimum wage for childcare workers to $15 an hour starting next year for the big childcare providers, and then with a three-year phase-in for smaller companies. Now, this initiative also states that the city must have a goal to make childcare affordable, costing no more than about 10% of a family's income, and that they need to come up with a plan to try to achieve that goal. But it doesn't include any funding for the proposal. The city council and mayor would have to find a way to fund out of the city budget, probably, an oversight board and some other costs related to I-107. The city council has also been working on, along with the mayor, for about a year, another proposal to fund preschool for all 3- and 4-year-olds and provide tuition credits on a sliding scale for low-income families. That's, in my mind, quite separate from the child care initiative. However, the ballot wording is going to make voters choose between the two initiatives to either vote for one or the other or to reject both.
And that's the city council's decision.
Yeah, and that is thoroughly the city council's decision. Now, the city council proposal has a funding mechanism, which is a 4-year property tax levy of about $43 per year on a house that's valued about $400,000 over 4 years. It's expected to raise about $14.5 million. And in my mind, this is, I think, a prime target for a lawsuit because, childcare, you know, raising the wage for childcare workers, I don't think is anywhere near the same as, funding affordable preschool for low-income families.
That might also be something that, Pete Holmes, as city attorney, has something mm-hmm. to say about, because the city attorney, of course, also has to review the
wording for the ballot initiatives, yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And if those are two separate things, then I think he would also have the authority to decouple them.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on, developments this week with Seattle City Light.
Yes, the superintendent of Seattle, the utilities, Jorge Carrasco, oddly enough, last week we talked about the enormous raise that he got from city council. And this week, oddly enough, the bad news started coming out. First, we heard about $17,500 contract with Brand.com, a PR consultant, to scrub not just the reputation of the utility company, but of Carrasco personally. The main target of it, in fact, was to influence search engine results and to try and scrub the web of search results to a critical Seattle Weekly article from 2008. Oh, well, hi there.
Hello.
At the same time, we also found out this week about Carrasco authorizing $125,000 in copper to be given to what turned out to be two con men that Carrasco had met literally in the lobby of City Light's secure facilities. They bumped into Carrasco and sold him on the idea that it was for a Native American Cherokee, for Cherokees back in Oklahoma. And Carrasco, within minutes, authorized the men to be given the scrap copper. The two turned out to be con men, and they drove off with 20 tons of copper wire and scrap metal worth $120,000. Now, for anybody who has been around, say, the radio industry or some other electronics industries, this has been an ongoing problem for a number of years, the value of copper and the fact that it gets stolen. In fact, there was a radio station up in Everett 3 or 4 years ago that was off the air for several months because the entire ground system basically was stolen by people looking to sell the copper, and the price of copper has gone up quite a bit in the last couple of years. So it becomes pretty valuable. Why Carrasco is authorizing this pretty much on the spot without doing any kind of background check into these guys, it kind of suggests that he's either very gullible or not very bright or both. But it really does speak again to the culture of being able to do more or less whatever he wants without any accountability. But these stories coming, literally a week after his enormous raise makes you wonder in both cases, and we're talking about things that happened, years ago, makes you wonder in both cases how long people have been sitting on this story and, why it happened to come out just after he got this enormous raise.
Actually, that story came out, I think, last December, but, and the Times kind of made a big deal of it because they hadn't reported it when it came out initially, but now they're discovering the story that was reported in other sources. But it does point to a lack of internal controls at the corporate level in City Light. Usually businesses, when you make a donation, you check the charity out. You make sure that they're a 501c3, that it's a legitimate organization.
Sure.
And that wasn't done in this case.
And especially when it's a public agency, there's a whole bunch of hoops that you jump through in order to get that donation.
Yeah, and this one incident led to changes at City Light in terms of how they make their charitable donations. So, you know, it was an expensive lesson learned. And it is a little surprising that Carrasco didn't have hadn't thought to put those kinds of checks in place when that's pretty standard policy in the business world.
All right. Moving on, some potential changes for Seattle City Schools.
Yeah, Jose Banda, who has been superintendent of Seattle Public Schools for only 2 years, is now a finalist for a similar position in the smaller district in Sacramento. Now, the way this is being spun by Banda and by the school district and by local media is, well, he wants to be closer to his family. He came up here from California. It's back in California, et cetera. But behind the scenes, once again, we have a superintendent who is, basically, in this case, probably fleeing in terror. The problem with Seattle Public Schools for years and years and years is that superintendents come and go, school board members come and go, but the senior staff in the school district pretty much runs the place, and they do so without a lot of accountability, either to board members or to the superintendent, and especially not to parents and teachers, and the contempt for parents and teachers within the school district and within the operations of the school district. It's been a problem for decades.
Yeah,
literally.
And I think the senior staff too have an attitude at this point that the superintendents come and go, and they don't have a lot of respect for them either.
No, well, that's what I was saying. And so the fact that Banda is applying for other positions so quickly tells you a lot about the cultural rot within Seattle Public Schools.
All right, moving on. Mayor Ed Murray doing a big speech this week.
Oh, speaking of cultural rot.
Yeah. Mayor Ed Murray gave a speech to the city council this week. Typically, the mayor only gives a speech to the city council once or twice a year on the state of the city. Murray decided that gun violence had reached a peak in the city of Seattle, even though statistics don't necessarily support an increase in crime in Seattle, statistics actually show that crime levels are going down. He decided to give a speech on his, what he called his Summer of Safety plan. It's a 15-point plan to address the, as I said, the perception of increased crime and violence in Seattle. It includes that, but it does include some interesting things in it. I think the best part of his plan is the proposal to move the Office of Professional Accountability outside the Seattle Police Department and put it under civilian control and oversight.
Which has been a long, long overdue.
Yeah. Folks have been requesting that for a long time. It also includes developing a community safety plan for each neighborhood in Seattle, and that's a proposal that came directly from the new chief of police, Kathleen O'Toole. She had mentioned that a couple weeks ago. It also includes expanding hours at community centers and providing more youth programs, a summer jobs for youth initiative. It also includes scheduling neighborhood walks so that politicians, police, and citizens in those neighborhoods can get together, walk through the neighborhood, and hear complaints about what areas of the neighborhood are high crime areas and what can be done about them. And it also includes holding a city-county gun violence prevention summit this fall. I don't know what will come out of that, but, you know, it's a start. So there are some good things in his proposal. I particularly like the efforts to involve citizens on the neighborhood level instead of just big citywide meetings after the fact when there's some kind of a crisis.
Yeah, and there have been a number of complaints in the last year or so from different neighborhoods that police enforcement has simply gone away. It's almost like SPD is pouting because of the reform process. And so...
Which they are, and so this is
a combination of trying to address some of the issues that have arisen as a result of that, and neighborhood concerns over lack of public safety, and also particularly with the OPA measure, trying to hold SPD to a higher level of accountability and civilian oversight. So again, we'll see if this sticks. We talked earlier about O'Toole coming in, and really having an immediate declaration of war against her and the reform process with the lawsuit from a chunk of SPD's officers. This is in part an effort by Murray to get that potential schism within SPD under control, but we'll see how it plays out, because it's not going to be enough by itself.
All right.
Oh, and O'Toole herself was confirmed this week, so.
Mm-hmm. All right. Also happening this week, a somewhat contentious Port of Seattle meeting.
Yeah, Port of Seattle Commissioner Courtney Gregoire proposed a $15.50 total compensation minimum wage for workers in restricted areas of SeaTac by 2017. It would have a $13 an hour cash minimum. The idea of total compensation, people may remember, came up during the City of Seattle debate over a $15 minimum wage, where business interests wanted to call redefine wages as total compensation, which is to say the cost of an employer an employee to the employer. So things like health care benefits would come under this, as well as retirement contributions, taxable education expenses, wages, tips, etc. That would all go into it, but again, there would be a $13 an hour cash floor on this, which is one way of preventing the total compensation idea from literally costing employees money. But the reason for this, and all five Port of Seattle commissioners eventually spoke out in favor of some variation of this proposal, so it looks like something will pass. But the real reason that it came up now is that on Thursday, the Washington State Supreme Court heard oral arguments on a lawsuit as to whether the City of SeaTac's Proposition 1, which passed last fall, applies to airport workers. Now, for years and years, Port of Seattle commissioners have argued that they can't possibly raise the wages of airport workers because they don't have authority over the airport, that was the city. And as soon, as the city passed Proposition 1, and advocates for the workers at the airport went to the city specifically because Port of Seattle was saying they didn't have jurisdiction, suddenly the Port of Seattle sued, saying the employers sued, saying SeaTac didn't have jurisdiction, and it's back in the port's lap. This is what is going to be decided by the Washington State Supreme Court. And so this proposal is in part the port saying to Washington State Supreme Court, well, you don't, you know, you can give it to us because we'll take care of these folks, and whether or not, in fact, it passes would depend a lot, I think, on what the state Supreme Court rules. The other piece of this is that it was sold not as a way to give a livable wage to workers, but as a security issue. It only applies to people within the secure areas of Seaport, so not the restaurants and various retail shops that are out in the main shopping area of SeaTac, for example, but only the ones that are behind the security screen. And the idea was to minimize security violations by reducing employee turnover so that employers are more accustomed to the security measures that are taking place. So livable wages for workers at the airport, a lot of the workers aren't even covered by this, and for none of them is it actually being expressed as a concern by Port of Seattle commissioners. So it's kind of a disturbing at that level.
All right. On to national and numerous Supreme Court rulings this week.
Yeah, the Supreme Court is nearing the end of their session, and as they usually do near the end of their session, they start to release a lot of the rulings on cases that they've heard throughout the year. This week, the Supreme Court released rulings on four cases of note. The first one, on Monday, they upheld the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. The EPA had sought to regulate greenhouse gas emissions under the Clean Air Act using the permitting programs they had set up under the Clean Air Act for regulating other pollutants from industry as well as power plants. And the Supreme Court upheld... And the Supreme Court said, well, yes, you can regulate greenhouse gas emissions, but not under the Clean Air Act. We give you the authority under our 2007 decision on the case Massachusetts versus the EPA, where the Supreme Court gave the EPA the right to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. So it was a partial win for the EPA, but a pretty big win, saying that yes, you can regulate greenhouse gas emissions, and yes, these are because power plants really are the largest single polluters in terms of greenhouse gas emissions in the United States. So it is a significant win for the EPA, even though there was some limits to what the EPA can do there. On Wednesday, the court unanimously ruled that police now have to get a warrant in order to search your cell phone, which is a big win for privacy advocates. And it will almost certainly be something that can be applied to laptop computers and tablet computers. The justices pretty much acknowledged that, yes, nowadays with the combination of smartphones and cloud computing, that people can literally carry their whole private life with them in their pocket, and that police shouldn't have automatic access to that when they arrest you and suspect that you've committed a crime. So that was a very big win for folks. Now, on Thursday, the Supreme Court issued two rulings. One was another unanimous ruling to limit the president's ability to do recess appointments. In the past, U.S. presidents have used recess appointments, usually in the break between annual congressional sessions, to appoint people to staff vacancies in the executive. In recent years, particularly with the Bush administration and now with the Obama administration, when the presidents have had Senates that have not wanted to hear their nominations and have not wanted to confirm appointments, the presidents have used recess appointments as a way to get around the Senate confirmation process. The justices ruled that instead of banning recess appointments altogether, which they could have done, the justices ruled that each session recess appointments can only happen in sessions where Congress is not meeting for more than 10 days. They could have limited it even further and said that recess appointments could only happen during the break, the summer break between annual congressional sessions, or they could have limited it to the president only being able to use recess appointments to fill vacancies that happened during that break between annual sessions. But instead, they just said the break has to be at least 10 days long.
Yeah.
This comes because in 2012, the Senate had been convening every 3 days in order to block recess appointments.
Yeah, specifically, a minority group of Republicans had been convening. It wasn't the full Senate.
Yeah.
It was just literally a handful of Republicans would meet every 3 days while everybody else was out of town in order to keep up the fiction that the Senate was in fact convened. That part was upheld. The four conservative members of the Supreme Court in a concurring opinion actually did argue for having recess appointments only during the break between the congressional sessions. So it was a close ruling in that sense. But overall, it was a 9-0 ruling for that. And the other one on Thursday also was unanimous.
Yeah, another unanimous ruling to strike down the anti-protest buffer zones outside abortion clinics in Massachusetts. Massachusetts had passed a law setting a 35-foot buffer zone around the entrance to abortion clinics because in Massachusetts there had been some actually violent protests. protests outside abortion clinics. And in, I believe it was 97, there was a shooting at a Massachusetts abortion clinic. So they sought to make it a safe zone for patients to come and go. And to do that, the Massachusetts legislature set up a 35-foot buffer zone. Now, when this law was passed, there were plenty of people around the country on the left who said, well, this is not necessarily a good thing because a buffer zone could be used against other types of protest as well. And now that the Supreme Court has unanimously struck down these buffer zones as a violation of the right to free speech in the Constitution, that means that I think protesters should be able to challenge other types of buffer zones that are established around, say, for example, meetings of the WTO or
political conventions.
These political conventions.
And if they're not struck down, basically the message at that point is that women seeking reproductive health care aren't as high a priority as, say, delegates to a political convention. But this is applied consistently, then yes, the protest cage is a mile or two away from where delegates are meeting should be a thing of the past.
Yeah.
So we'll wait and see. All right. Also this week, a ruling regarding no-fly lists.
Yeah, a U.S. district judge in Oregon ruled that the government's no-fly list violates Americans' constitutional rights, particularly because there's no way for anyone to contest that their name is on the list, and there's no way for you to get your name removed. The government came back and argued that people whose names are on the no-fly list could always petition a U.S. appeals court. But the judge disagreed, saying that that was too onerous, that the U.S. government has to come up with procedures that allow people to challenge having their name on the list and a way for them to actually, a procedure in which they can actually get their name removed. And I have to say, it's been 13 years, and this has been a long time coming.
And there have been any number of people who have erroneously been put on the list and don't find out until they go and try and fly.
Yeah, in fact, the lawsuit was brought by four Americans who have Arabic-sounding names, three of whom are former members of the U.S. military.
Also this week, a release of a important document related to the U.S. drone assassination program.
Yeah, the federal appeals court released a heavily redacted copy of the government's legal memo supposedly justifying the targeted assassination of U.S. citizen Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki was targeted by a drone strike in Yemen and literally assassinated by the U.S. government. Government lawyers argued in the September 2010 memo that the law passed by Congress in 2001, immediately after September 11th, which allowed military force against the perpetrators of 9/11, the so-called authorization to use military force, was the basis of their decision. And it said that U.S. citizens can be targeted abroad if, and this is a direct quote, a capture operation is infeasible and that the targeted person is a part of a dangerous enemy force and is engaged in activities that pose a continued and imminent threat to U.S. persons or interests. And now I want to just point out that that wording is a continued and imminent threat is the wording that they used, and they said against U.S. persons or interests. So it's very, very broad. The memo itself did not contain any evidence against Awlaki in particular, even though the memo was literally written to deal with his case in particular. So we have no clue as to what evidence the U.S. government, the U.S. military may have had to show that Awlaki actually met those criteria.
Yeah, this actually was a justification that went far beyond even the John Yoo memos during the Bush administration. Very, very broad. And people may remember that not only was al-Awlaki assassinated, but 2 weeks after that, his 16-year-old son was as well.
In a separate incident. And we have no clue, again, what any kind of evidence they may have had against al-Awlaki's 16-year-old son.
All right. And then finally, nationally, climate change.
Yeah. Several former cabinet members, mostly from Republican presidents, George Shultz, Henry Paulson, and then Robert Rubin from the Clinton administration, among others, calling for a carbon tax this week in a report on the cost and national security implications of climate change over the coming decades. This is particularly significant because it's mainstream Republicans working for former Republican presidents, including Nixon, Reagan, and Bush Sr., and Bush Jr. But Robert Rubin, the Clinton appointee in the list, also somebody who has heavy, heavy connections to Wall Street and particularly to oil and fossil fuel industries on Wall Street. So these are people from the very conservative business community saying that, you know, from a business standpoint, this is something that we have to deal with because there are going to be huge costs here. Now, whether that has any influence in the modern Republican Party, which has moved beyond, responding to the concerns of financial elites to an alternate universe all their own is an open question. But the fact that you've got conservative economic pillars of the establishment like this, who have vastly profited over the years from the very same fossil fuel industries that are causing much of climate change, now coming out and saying we got to do something about this, it is a positive development, even though it's much, much later than it should have happened.
All right. And on to Iraq.
Yeah, actually the funding requests, the Obama administration this week requested $500 million from Congress to arm Syrian rebels, although of course they gave no details of who they were going to arm, train, and what the details of the training might be.
Yeah, they talked about moderate groups, even though there really aren't any that have any impact.
Well, or any that are easy to identify who their leadership is. That's, I think, been the main issue with the Syrian rebel groups. And of course they had no way, they had no plan for how to keep the weapons out of the hands of the very well organized Islamic extremists who are fighting in Syria. And in addition, another $500 million will soon be going to Iraq as part of the $5 billion counterterrorism fund that the president announced in his West Point speech last month. And that, I think, is also of concern, too. The U.S. already has some 300 advisors in Iraq and is flying both airplanes and drones over much of Iraq, as well as armed drones now are flying over the city of Baghdad. So we are involved.
And we're grouping those two stories because they are basically the same story at this point. There's sort of this legal fiction that Syria and Iraq are two separate conflagrations. They're not at this point.
They're not at this point. This week, the United Sunni militias in Iraq managed to secure just about every major border post along in Anbar province and in the north and west of Iraq that hasn't already been controlled by the Kurds. So they are very well on their way to securing the integrity of their own territory.
Yeah, not just that, but they've also pretty much obliterated the Iraq-Syria border, and they also now have several of the crossings between Syria and Jordan and between Iraq and Jordan, and there's the threat now also that this war will spill over into the territory of Jordan as well.
All right. Events.
Yeah, this week is Pride weekend. Is Pride Fest. We won't talk about what people are proud about because, you know, that would be you'd be so gay. This afternoon between noon and 5 o'clock at Cal Anderson Park up on Capitol Hill will be Family Day, and then from 4 o'clock until sunset, the Pride Fest Capitol Hill will be taking place at 11th and Pine on Capitol Hill. So look out for the party there. And then Sunday there will be the usual parade down 4th Avenue starting at 11 o'clock, from downtown to Seattle Center, and then Pride Fest itself from noon to 8 o'clock at Seattle Center. Beyond that, there are a couple other events going on tonight that people should check out also. Take Back Your Power, a great documentary screening, taking place at, Bethany, Church in Bacon Hill, 6230 Beacon Avenue South, $5 to $10 suggested donation. And then also tonight, the Backbone Campaign is having a fundraiser, Chocolatada, which they did last year. It was a great success. They're doing it again this year. Lots and lots of chocolate. Tickets for that are $20 and up. It'll be held at 1927 Events, which is a venue at 1927 3rd Avenue in downtown Seattle. So go check that out and help the Backbone Campaign, which does great, great work.